Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody to this afternoon's session, AI and its effect on humanity, humanity and the social sciences. We're going to begin today with our first speaker, Cheryl Chin from Intellectual Consortia. Her title is Artificial Intelligence and the Stories We Tell Ourselves, the Authorial Leverage of Ideology.
Ooh.
Thank you. So I'm going to start by asking a couple questions, and there's not really a right or wrong answer. I just wanted to get a sense of where you're all at with thinking about these things, these topics that we've been talking about. And so my first question really is, so between a cat and a squirrel, raise your hand if you think a cat is more intelligent. All right. What about between a cat and the latest iPhone? Who thinks the cat is more intelligent? Okay, interesting. What about a goldfish? Who thinks the goldfish is more intelligent? All right. Oh, still a lot of people. What about a TI-85 versus the latest iPhone? Anybody? Oh, we have some people here. We have some fans of the TI-85. How about the latest iPhone and a pair of scissors? Who thinks that? All right. Yeah, more of you. And then how about who thinks the iPhone might be more intelligent than a human mind or a human? Ooh, okay. Because that's kind of like what's bringing us all here together today, right? That's like the question of this conference is kind of posing this idea of like of what makes us human. And I really enjoy the spaces like this that come together. Another thing about me is that while I'm going to go through a bunch of different stories today with you, I really appreciate the spaces that already exist here. So for example, I really love that we had a birding activity this morning. So how many of you went to that activity this morning? A couple of you, yeah. And it was really cool to see people who are enthusiastic about animals. I myself really love birds and always have a great curiosity about what they are and why they're there and what they're doing. And I think this guy was in charge. That was probably Doug that was in the program, right? I looked him up. He seemed to know a lot about what's going on. He seemed to know like everything there was to know about the birds that we were seeing here in San Diego. And so, you know, and I didn't just explore the spaces in this area. We went to, is that Coronado, right? That's a place, a very popular place around here. And lo and behold, I saw a bird there too, and it landed right in front of me. And I was very curious as to what it was, because I had no idea. I'd never seen a bird like that I could identify. And so, of course, I did what anyone would do. I messaged Doug, and I said, hey, Doug, what kind of bird is this? And he said, you know, this is a house sparrow. I'm kidding. I don't know Doug, he doesn't know who I am. I actually use this app on my phone. Imagine if I had to, every time I wanted to identify a bird, I just messaged Doug. I just like was like, hey Doug, you don't know who I am, but I just really wanna know what this is. And so here, I was able to give a photo to this program and it was able to understand and know what kind of bird it was. And this actually happened during the pandemic when I was looking at into my backyard. And in my backyard, there were these finches, but I didn't know they were finches. And then I learned that there is a black Phoebe. And I learned that here is a mourning dove. I was really excited to be able to identify it. And thanks to my phone, it was able to teach me to understand and be able to identify the qualities of the characteristics of these animals. And so, you know, I will still say that this phone far surpasses me in its understanding of birds and being able to interpret birds. And probably for like most human beings around, this phone is probably better identifying what kind of bird by its picture and image. I don't know about Doug though. I would have to do like a side-by-side comparison to find out, but we'll leave that to that. What I wanted to really talk about today is evaluating the technologies that we invent. And so when we talk about artificial intelligence, there's a lot of questions around that. And a lot of people are always asking, you know, what is it and how do we know we're doing the right things with it? But what I like to tell people when people ask me about what artificial intelligence is I like to tell them that it's actually a very complicated question. It means something different to different people in different points in time. And depending on which community you ask, it might mean something very separate from what another community might think. So for example, if you are a game developer, then the ghosts that chase Pac-Man would be considered artificial intelligence. But if you talk to a lot of the modern machine learning researchers, they would say, oh no, it has to be deep learning, right? And so who defines that? Who gets to say what's what? Well, there's just a very rich and complex history around that. And another important question that we kind of all commonly agree on is that technology should exist to serve the general human good. And so we want it to be human-centered. Now, the issues with that is kind of often we don't define what that is, like who is the human we're talking about? Who is that human in the loop? And so I was gonna go through a cross-section of history, kind of pick a few moments in time to talk about these concepts that evolved in the work in artificial intelligence. And so initially, when we thought of human and AI collaboration, we came up with this concept of mixed initiative in the human-computer interactions community. And the idea was that the human has an initiative, the computer has an initiative, and they come together to accomplish a goal. And then in the computational creativity space, so yet another community of researchers, they called them co-creative interfaces. Now, I feel like this group here, you all have some familiarity with this concept of co-creating, right? And then when machine learning, the advent of machine learning, where we required more data, we required more better data, we created this concept called humans in the loop. So there's a human in the loop, and you'd crowdsource the data oftentimes, or you would have humans labeling the data. And the idea is that the algorithm is not just running fast ahead, but the algorithm is actually kind of checking in with the human to see if it's kind of doing the right thing, right? Except that wasn't good enough. And so today we have human AI interaction, which is really trying to bring the human back into the center of things. It's not that the algorithm's kind of running ahead and the human's kind of coming in to check on it, but that there's a human AI collaboration that is also for human centeredness. And of course that kind of leads to another question of what does it mean to be human or human centered, right? And I would break it down into these three main points. So to be human means, to be human is kind of the question that a lot of these talks have been asking all week. And for this talk specifically, we at least agree that there's an expressive intent involved as we build any technology, specifically AI, and that the development is motivated by what that means to be human, and that the technology should be assisting us in how we can be better than that. And that doesn't still answer the question of what it means to be human. So I'm going to go through a couple examples in the symbolic AI world to kind of illustrate the ways in which we understand our values and the meaning behind these tools that we make. And so really what this boils down to is storytelling. And so a lot of my work, early work in grad school was around this idea of like intelligence and storytelling or narrative intelligence. And one of my favorite quotes was from the Cambridge Introduction to Narrative, where it actually says that humans inevitably see everything as a narrative, that we can't have something happen and not really incorporate it into some story. Incorporating it to a story will be what enables us to truly understand what something is. And then Roger Schenck, an AI researcher, also later said, that it's beyond that, that we actually fit stories to patterns that are comfortable for us, and that these stories really adhere to belief systems that we've constructed. So I'm going to give three examples of how that's kind of played out in AI history. This, by the way, is the narrative aspect of things, where there was where some of the storytelling elements, I don't know if some of you are familiar with the unreliable narrator, but that there are things that we do to contort and to maybe even indulge in these cognitive illusions when we think about the technologies that we use. So the three examples that I have here are, of course, first we have, it's hard to sometimes avoid talking about Alan Turing, but he is very pivotal in a lot of this work. So how many people have read the paper, Can Machines Think? Well, the rest of you should definitely check it out if you have any curiosity about the state of the art. It's a great read, and it's very digestible. And it kind of asks some of the early questions that shape the direction of the technology that we're building today. And a lot of it is around, again, this idea of a lot of the evaluation of which, whether the technology is successful or not, is actually built upon the human's interpretation of that. And so that could be very evidence-based, for which Abelson calls cold cognition, or it could be very like feelings-based or emotions-based or affectively based, which he called hot cognition. And some of these bases can be kind of susceptible to some cognitive illusions, right, that I said earlier around these technologies that we use. And Abelson represented this in this amazing, I have this book actually, and I love looking at vintage charts, but this computer simulation of personality book, he writes about the aspect of rationalization and how we model the stories and the narratives and the facts around us. And so the narrative that we tell ourselves can be manipulated to kind of fit into the belief system that he had. And he even said it's an attitudinal problem for which we can't even really want to have a desire to change our belief system, and it will do so many things. He called these rationalization mechanisms that to enable people to maintain the things of which they believe. And then this, of course, further goes into 1999, an ideologically biased history machine. And this is actually my advisor. So I worked with him a little bit after he made this, but I was really inspired by this work. And he took the history of the last 1,000 years, broke it into chunks, and had audiences respond to certain questionnaires throughout a viewing of a documentary. And then they were able to procedurally generate the narrative based off of the ideological bias of the audience. And there were two interesting criticisms that came out of this. One is that, like, at the time this came out, there was a bit of a, like, depending on the viewing that you had, you could have had like maybe like a very pro-communist telling of history. And then people would wonder, why would the government fund something like this? And in which case they were kind of missing the point. And then there was another side where people were like, isn't this like, aren't you building a propaganda generator? Aren't you just like creating a machine that just spins facts into alternate truths? And to that, I think that there was a, the response was that, like, the more we understand about how these systems work, the more of a literacy we have, the more we can actually tackle the ills that come with them. And so even though these things may not show up in technology, humans are still able to leverage them in ways that could be harmful, and us understanding it and making that understanding accessible can only help improve these situations and circumstances. And so what, right? How do we know that one system is more effective than the other system, and for what purpose, and why do we even have this to begin with? So here, this was one of the pillars of my dissertation. I developed this framework called authorial leverage, and we were really looking at whether an AI system actually improved the quality of the thing you were trying to do. So if you were trying to tell a story, did it actually improve the quality of the story? And if so, was it 100 times harder to use the AI system than to not use the AI system? And so what I said in my work was that the theoretical side is that your audience experience or the outcome over the amount of effort that it costs for you to use or even build, construct this system, and how scalable was that? This kind of broke down into smaller components, that the quality and the variations, a lot of the idea of having something procedural generative is that you have multiple variations and also your control over that. And so I don't have time today to talk about all the different charts and graphs that went into that, but we had ways of qualifying the environment we were in and then quantifying it for analysis and comparisons. So the whole basis of this was to understand that there was a human expressive intent to get from point A to point B, and did the technology help us get there in some better way? Was it able to reduce the effort it would normally have taken to get there? That's one way to do it. This is a very symbolic representation, of course, and there's, of course, other ways we can learn. We don't have to iterate and outline all the rules ourselves. We can actually learn and observe by watching human behavior. And so this, of course, leads to this area called machine learning, which is very popular today. When people talk about the AI advancements or the hype around artificial intelligence, they're, of course, talking about machine learning. And what's relevant to know is that, you know, in 2017, Sundar said to all of Google, we are now an AI-first company. He took all of the research groups that were in the proximity of the center of campus and moved them to the center of campus and said, we are now an AI first company. And that indicated that there was some huge advancements on the brink. why this happened was because there were so many more access, there were so many advancements at the time that enabled artificial intelligence development and acceleration in the machine learning space. Lots of data sets and lots of computation. And of course, companies like Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, they all have access to these tools. And it really brings us to this question of what we're trying to improve. So I'll talk a little bit about some of these deep learning projects that that I've been part of. And the thing that I worked, the area that I worked primarily in is this area of creativity and understanding, again, human expressive intent. So one of the projects I worked on was Project Magenta, and we were training machines for creative expressivity. The idea behind that is that given that there is an art or an artist, that there's some development that happens that creates that artwork, right? But then before that, there's a research foundation that enables that developer to do that, and then the data that backs up the research, or data that trains the model that enables that research. And so here's an example. There's a model. It's open source. It's called Performance RNN. It's taken from a piano competition data set. So it's like, what is the machine learning from? Is it crawling the internet for every MIDI file it can find? Or is there a kind of a better curated corpus of information that's going to better identify the type of thing you wanted to learn? And so there was just happened to be a piano competition where they recorded through a MIDI disc clavier, which is a grand piano that also serves as an electronic keyboard, and was able to read all the inputs from these classical performers. And they were able to build models out of that. And not only were we able to do work in trying to create these pieces, we actually went to CalArts and worked with aspiring composers and producers to ask them what kind of tools would be useful for them in development. If these models actually were able to be incorporated into their workflow, what would that look like and how would that help? If you want to know more, g.co/magenta. Another example, does anybody know what game this is from? Anybody? This is from a game called Smash Brothers. Anybody knows, heard of Smash Brothers? And in this game, there's an ability to chat. We're going to talk a little bit about natural language. And so when you chat, there's a lot of, there. You know, when you're texting people, there's not really a lot of regulation that happens there. In situations and in virtual environments, here's another one. Does anyone know this game? This is a game called Hearthstone, a really fun game. They also have the same setup where they're actually limiting the amount of expression you have, but they don't want it to be entirely non-existent. And so the idea is that like, rather than have the machine learning model generate language, so using natural language generation, we utilize the natural language understanding part to find what we call semantic similarity. And then you're able to match words to the words that someone might want to express. We match it to a pre-selected, pre-authored list of available expressions. So you have this expression space, and then that gets communicated out into the world. And so we're able to build these models and utilize them, leverage them in a way where it's actually bringing utility to a certain environment or a certain function. And so what's the latest things that we have going on today in machine learning would be our work in large language models. Dozens of terabytes of data with hundreds of billions of parameters. And you can see some of the big companies that are working in those areas that some of which you can kind of see examples of or transcripts of, but they're really amazing how they work. But what I wanted to show you today was text to image. Has anybody tried any of the text to image models? You can kind of see like small versions of them online. Yeah, and this isn't like, you know, like, oh, the machine learning model is able to interpret the image and then write a cool caption. That would be image to text. Text to image is actually writing a sentence like, a transparent sculpture of a duck made out of glass. The sculpture is in front of a painting of a landscape. And then having a machine learning model or some sort of algorithm reconstruct that and create that picture from that. And it's pretty amazing. It's pretty compelling. And this is one of the latest things. You can actually try it online now if you go online. There's some smaller versions of this, but I got to test out Imogen myself, and it took me kind of like I spent a whole afternoon working on it. And so my desktop, I think I was saving all the pictures of my desktop look like that. Initially, what would you think of writing in a, when you're like trying to generate something ridiculous, right? And then it just kind of kept going, like from there, you know, not only did I look for a cute pile of squirrels, I wanted to know what pile of squirrels would look like in comparison. And we also had like, you know, you're always looking for clip art. What if you could just generate it? And then, you know, what if you wanted a logo with a squirrel on it? And like, could you just generate it there? And then all these different scenarios. Like, I wanted to know what the cutest squirrel in the world looked like according to this machine learning model. And then I'm also really into different types of music. And so I was trying different different setups and different. And I just kept going and going and going, and it was really good at stylizing. If I said, in the style of Pixar, in the style of a certain painter, dressing up like Pokemon for Halloween. And I know you must be getting tired at this point, but you know, the last one I had was a squirrel tucked in bed with a tiny teddy bear. And so when we look at the risks of these technological advancements, we have what is algorithmic bias, right? And I think actually the next speaker is going to talk a bit about that. And we know that there is like hard, it's hard to kind of represent all the different edge cases. And then we have internet addiction where, you know, with the attention economy that there is an aspect of the algorithm just getting so good at knowing what engages us that it's even better than us. And that we don't even know what's happening. And of course, I'm talking about a lot of the short video programs that we have on our phone that are able to just kind of keep us scrolling infinitely. Then we have societal manipulation where we see these unregulated platforms that have, where you have, potentially bad players utilizing these very powerful platforms, but without any oversight and being able to kind of have potentially harmful effects on different societies. And then I think something happens along the way. There's some unrealistic leap that goes on and we end up with like the Terminator. And what I'd like to like really talk about is why there is really this tension of handling these technologies. I think there's kind of this fantasticness versus this frustration in working with these tools. The language models are amazing. The text to image is amazing. But what's frustrating is the innumerable harms that may arise, and also how can we leverage these for useful, for how do we take this and we turn it into something that is useful, that is cost effective. And I think that for these reasons, we tend to fantasticalize, we think about the Terminators, we think about these other scenarios because of the hope that we may not be able to resolve these problems. And we think about the way, whether semantic, or whether AI, you know, deserves to have human rights or deserves equity like humans do. When we can't even solve that problem amongst other humans, and we think about equity for an AI versus equity for the people working in the data centers that enable that AI to run. And so I just want to end with this. This is what my hope is for the field and for the research area. And this is some of the stuff that I'm working on currently. We need to first increase literacy and technology. And I truly believe that when we ask Jesus what is the summary of things above all things? And he says, to love God with your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And to me, this aspect of like understanding enables our capacity to love God more with our minds. And as we've seen 100 years ago, even in basic reading and writing, 100 years ago, we had, there were only 90% of the world was able to read and write. And now we had 90% of the world was illiterate. And now today, 90% of the world can read and write. We know this aspect of literacy is ever evolving. We also need to advocate for on-the-job training. And I think sometimes there's so much emphasis on kingdom building that we don't think about the ecclesia, the metropolis, the city that represents people, citizenship, belonging, representation. And so the advocate for on-the-job training is kind of a way to kind of get ahead of the automation that has always been happening, and it's to no surprise. We also need better process around data, how we get data, the quality of the data, how we keep data, how we can improve data. And also the ways that like I love in one of my favorite verses is how how Jesus says that we know a tree by its fruit. Good trees produce good fruit, and good trees do not produce bad fruit. And it's very observable. I love how that God makes the statement about using our senses to discern, and that it's not all just a leap of faith. We need avenues for democratization. And so to me, this is really a facet of understanding all creation and liberating it in a way that is equitable for all people. And then finally, and this is the closing point, is that we just need to value empathy over speed. And so I work with some of the people who've had some of the most educational privileges in the world, and a lot of them constantly feel like they're falling behind. And I often wonder if there's a sort of, you know, colonial inherited mindset that I need to get to a discovery first, and then I put my flag in it, and now I've brought value to myself. And so how do we, again, I began with the greatest commandment. How do we, you know, love our neighbors as ourselves in this pursuit of research? I know as a researcher, there's always this need to move fast, but there's also a lot of these things going around us to think about. And so the conclusion is, as we think about AI and the stories we tell ourselves about AI, it's really a question of what it means to be human, how we can be better at that. And with that, I say thank you. Check out bit.ly Passion Talks 32, where we'll be doing virtual poster sessions.
Question, if you'll raise your hand, I'll run the microphone over to you.
Thanks for the talk. That was very interesting, very engaging. I'd love to chat more about it later. One question I have is, you know, technology, AI is something that's captured the imagination of everybody. It's this technology that people think of as magical in a sense, right? But often with technologies, as they fail to deliver on the promises they seem to give, right? Who are some of the people that are behind the scenes on AI that might be taken advantage of through the process? You've mentioned data center workers and things like that. Are there others?
Yeah, I mean, even in when we talk about the crowdsourcing or human in a loop, a lot of these humans in the loop are people working in data centers. So like they're working in these computer centers. You have the people maintaining the servers, and you have people sitting at terminals just labeling data all day long. And so this idea, it's like the human in the loop. And what we're doing is, in order to get machines to behave more like humans, we're treating humans like machines to get them to give us the data to make the machines behave more like humans.
Other questions? Okay, let's thank Cheryl Chin one more time.